And with that, I'd like to introduce Mike H. from Richmond. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. First, I want to thank y'all, Blue Ridge Group, for having me up to speak. It's truly an honor to be useful today, you know, to be of service, because believe you me, there was a point in time in my life where, you know, anything I did, you know, it was about getting something from it. It was about cost. My time cost, you know. So, again, I want to thank you all for having me up here. Thank you, Sam, for inviting me. I love the feeling that I'm having right now. I'm speaking at a home group because it's a different feeling than I have when I go to the jails and the prisons and things, you know. It's, you know, today I have a new way of life where I'm not, I don't have any charges pending or anything anymore. But it's just that feeling, you know, of going in there of, I guess it's a wreckage of the past. You know what I mean? But I love the feeling that I get coming to home groups, and if it's no more than just attending, but and to speak is even a more serene, you know, humble feeling that I have being here tonight. So I want to thank you all for giving me that experience and to have this opportunity to share with you what it was like, what happened, and what's it like today. My sobriety date is March 4th, 2005. I'm sponsored. My sponsor is Mark N. My grand sponsor is Tom I. And I am very proud of my sponsorship line because it's good sponsorship that was very, very, very important that keeps me here. John Barleycorn got me here because he brought me to my knees. But, you know, one of the first things that kept me here was the good sponsorship. I'm a member of the Interaction Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Richmond. It's where I'm dedicated. It's where I belong. It's where I'm committed. It's where I perform service. It's where my voice is heard. It's I'm an active member of the group. I'm on the boots on the ground, you know. I'm involved in all levels of service. I was the past newcomers committee chair. So again, you know, I'm just enthusiastic and thrilled about whatever they need me to do, you know. As I said, I'm sponsored, and I sponsor guys, you know, and if they want to do something with the truth, because I can only give them the truth, you know, whether they want to do something with the truth, that's totally up to them. So again, you know, again, I'm enthusiastic, and I'm really thrilled about this little piece of heaven that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it wasn't always that way, you know. I come from the inner city of Richmond. I come from Creighton Court. They call them projects, or in a more general word, I come from the ghetto. It was nothing but despair, destruction, terror around me, you know. I'm the youngest of three from a single parent home. I was immediately resentful at my father for not being there, you know. So I always looked outside of the home for role models. My first role models was the boys in the hood, the boys on the corner singing them street corner harmonies and drinking what they called pluck. I later found out why they called the wine pluck, because when they took the tops off, they pluck them away because they hadn't planned long. I mean, till you finish. You know what I mean? So that's why they called it pluck. Yeah. And, you know, the guys had those names and reputations that superseded, you know. You know, there was the Jackson Ward Five was one of the gangs, and there was a gang called the Dirty Dozens. There was this guy who was notorious. His name was Freddie Ford. That wasn't his real name, but that was his street name. And, you know, I never saw this guy as a child. But, you know, because of his reputation, I thought he was 7 foot tall and shot fire from his eyes. And when I got sober and came into the fellowship and got to know him by his real name, the guy's only 4 feet tall. You know? And it was like, as a direct result of that experience of meeting him now sober, it was like I didn't stand for anything. I didn't stand for nothing, so I'd fall for anything. So it was basically whatever I heard, I would just come to believe it. You know, as a child coming up, you know, I got a lot of misinformation from the streets because my father wasn't there to raise me as a father would. So I was very resentful at that. So my first role models was the boys in the hood. Being the youngest of three, now my mother, being in a single parent home, my mother was a good provider. Even though we came up in the ghettos and things, you know, she always provided well. We had fine garments, clothing. We never went without a meal. My mother worked at Mill and Rose when it was segregated, and we was able to wear, you know, the clothes from Mill and Rose. So that was pretty cool for me, you know, because one of the experiences that I remember from that, I was prideful, I guess you would want to say, even then, was this long black trench London fog trench coat that my mother had gave me, and it had the fur lining on the inside, and that thing was cool, man, you know. Mother was a firm lady, because, see, I left that thing at the playground, and she sent me back several times to go and find it, and it wasn't there. And she gave me a pretty good whooping for that. So that was the manifestation of resentment towards authorities. She used to magnetize the chores on the refrigerator. Long list of chores for each kid on the refrigerator. And as a child, I just wanted to play. And I thought that was rather cruel. Problem with authorities. Then I had an older sister who used to enforce these chores. So a resentment against authorities is a direct result of the firmness of my mother. Now I got a resentment against women. Because I grew up with this philosophy that when I got big enough, I wasn't going to never let a woman tell me what to do. Because my sister used to roust us, you know. Father not being there, seeking out role models, had an older brother. He was the competition. Everything he had, I wanted. I wanted his toys, his clothes. Later on, as we got older, I wanted his girlfriends. I wanted to outdo him in basketball, football. Anything he did, I could do better. So he was my measuring stick, if you will. He was the competition. But, you know, coming along as a child, you know, I was and already... I guess you want to say curious about a lot of things, you know. You know, I wasn't a bad kid, really, you know. But I thought I was for a long time because, you know, I did one thing that really made me feel really low about myself. I did one of those curious things that kids do is, you know, the little girl, show me yours, I'll show you mine. And what happened was it just scared the bejesus out of me when I did that. Because, you know, I didn't see anything, so I thought something was wrong with girls for a long time. And, you know, and I thought I was a bad person for that. But, you know, it's just the curiosities of kids, you know. I found out one of those, and I found out about that in my sex inventories because I had a resentment towards myself in that. So, you know, thank God for this process that I've gotten healthier in that aspect, too. I'll try to share with you a little bit. Well, I guess I'll say it now that I got an ongoing relationship with a beautiful woman today, and it doesn't scare the bejesus out of me. You know? But y'all pray for me on that too, because sometimes I let her tell me what to do. You know, I'm breaking my code here. You know, breaking my philosophies, right? But you know, again, coming up in school, no real problems. You know, but what happened was one of the jarring things that happened was that. We moved from the Creighton Court Projects into Midlothian Village over on the south side of town. Now, this was a new scene for me because and on the east end of town in Creighton Court, departments or the projects, there was only one and two floors. And when we moved to south side in Creighton Court, it was three-floor apartments. So it was like I moved on up to the south side like the Jeffersons type of thing. So it was a new scene, you know. In the summer times, right around this transitional period, me and my brother, you know, my sister always went to my other grandmother's house. I didn't spend much time there. But I want to share something about my father's side of the family. You know, alcoholism ran really strong over that side. My step-grandfather was a bootlegger. My father's brother, he was a very mean alcoholic. I remember for the little bit, one of the occurrences that I did spend time over at my grandmama's house on my father's side, I remember seeing my uncle come down the street and turn to come up the steps, and it was like the drunks on the porch parted like the Red Sea for this guy, because it was like, don't say nothing to him, because if you do, somebody's going to get cut. You know, he was very violent. He's sober today, too. He was very intricate in my beginning in this plight, in my first attempt at getting sober. But on my mother's side, me and my brother used to go to my grandmother's house quite often. And the times I was telling you about when we made the transition to moving into Southside, we would go to my grandmother's house in the summertime, and I gravitated to hanging out with this older guy. He wasn't only 1 or 2 years older, but, you know, I'm seeking out role models. So, you know, I gravitate to this guy, and he led me into breaking into houses and stealing bicycles long before I took my first drink. In my grandmother's basement, I had like 6'10 speeds. So I had the mental obsession and the compulsions for more even then. You know, I could only ride one at a time, you know. All together, I had 7, but 6 of them were in the basement. I remember that. And broke into many houses. And that was in the summertime. But during the school period, you know, living on the south side in Midlothian Village, I had another friend that was I hung out with, who was older than me. And I pretty much followed him into smoking cigarettes. But there was this thing about this guy, you know. He was just mild-mannered, you know. He wasn't erratic enough for me, if you will, because I had, as a child, earlier childhood age, I had heard about the reputations he had and seen some stuff with the boys in the hood over on the east side. And then on the south side, I'm hanging with this guy who's rather meek, but there's these guys in front of the pool who has that chatter about them. They talk loud, and they fought, and they shot dice, and they had the reputations, you know. And getting a little bit older, you know, and I'm on this new scene, you know, I got to get in, you know. It was like, I've come to learn that really it was a fear. I didn't want to get devoured by them. So I had to get a little crazy, but how do I get there, you know? The drive to be accepted was on, you know. You know, especially after not being, feeling like I was accepted by my father and don't want to be accepted by my brother, you know. So the drive to succeed in life, if you will, was on. So I was like, how can I, you know, this guy, I'm like, man, you know, let's do something. Let's break into something or something, you know. Let's kick a store window in or something. I mean, you know, all you want to do is smoke cigarettes and, you know, and you know. So, you know, So I came up with a novel, Alcoholic Idea. You know, I was told at that time that I could sing a little bit. So, you know, to get accepted, I know what I do. You know, and right about this time I got into middle school, I joined a band. I was singing a band because I told I could sing a little bit. You know, I used to do as a kid, used to, you know, sing for little nickels and dimes for my mother and her friends when they sit around and drink their Smirnoff, you know. But my mother, and I say that, but my mother, she was not an alcoholic. She was a sociable drinker, whatever that is. But no, she was a sociable drinker. So I remember singing and dancing with her, and I was told I could sing a little bit. So to get acceptance on this new scene, I joined a band. And you know, and then we were singing Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, smooth, cool stuff, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I wanted to get a girl too, you know. I wanted acceptance in all levels, you know what I mean? And, you know, ironically enough, two of the guys from out the front of the pool who had the reputation, they jumped in the band. So now, you know, I'm hanging out with these guys, and we only did 2 concerts because the two of the guys from the front of the pool beat up the drummer, you know, because they say he took the money from the concert, and they beat him up, so the band dispersed. But now I'm in with the crew, you know what I'm saying? And I moved on from this guy who's rather soft-spoken. And it was right about that time when I found alcohol. You know, this was somewhere around 73, 74, and the scene and on the streets was changing. You know, the guys were coming home from Vietnam, you know what I'm saying? And everything was going up to another level. You know what I'm saying? All the recreations was going up to another level. There was one of the friends who I hung out with that was in the fold with us. I remember I worked with him and his mother at a country club, you know, just doing dishes and stuff. And I remember me and him stole some wine from the job. Okay, he was my kind of dude, right? He willing. But you know what, though? You know, it's blind. You know, I stole this bottle of wine that had this wicker around it. Just like this wicker around it. I didn't know what it was. I mean, it just looked, it got wicker around it. So, you know, curiosity as a potential alcoholic, what's inside of there? Of course, you know, it didn't do anything for me. But the reason why it didn't do anything for me was because my friend who stole his bottle, as we commenced to gulp, he stuck his finger in his throat to make himself regurgitate. And I was like, why'd you do that? He said, because it gave him a better feeling of the drunk or the high. I'm not doing that. And now you done messed up my drink. You know what I'm saying? Because I don't want to, you know, I was distracted, if you will. So, you know, I can't run with this guy. You know, even though he's with the fold, I got to sort of gravitate. You know, okay, he's cool, but I ain't telling nobody what he does. But I'm sort of moving on with the other guys, because what the other guys that I did move over to the side with was the guys who came up with the idea. They know what to do. We would do what's called snatch and grabs. We would go to the local convenience stores, and you would stuff as many bottles of wine in your pants and take off running. And if you get caught, the charge is yours. And I took pride because I got away on two different occasions at least, to be able to stick three Mad Dog 2020 purple wine bottles in the front of my pants and three in the back and put a shirt over and run and take off. And I got away with that twice. I took pride in stealing that Mad Dog 2020. And that's when I found that drink. You know, I took pride in empty bottles being laid all through the apartment complexes as we walked through the hood drinking wine. You know, I took pride because I belonged now. You know what I'm saying? So I'm a proud member of these guys here, you know. And still no educational problem, no school problems, you know. Back then, we wasn't shooting up each other, you know. We just had a couple of hand fights, you know what I'm saying, and I could sing a little bit, so I get a little little recognition from the girls, and so I feel like some of the guys in the group, they following me for real, because you know I'm the lead singer, you know, some prideful stuff here. But I remember stealing that Mad Dog 2020, and that's when it was like it unleashed a beast inside of me. Everything about me changed. You know, it was like I no longer listened to the Earth, Wind, and Fire stuff no more that I used to sing. I went straight to Peter Frampton. It was, do you feel like I do? Man, I live by that philosophy. It was like before he get to the talk box by that wah, 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 I had to be there. You know, so I drank with a vigilance, you know, because I wanted to feel like he did, you know. And the illusion was that music sounded better. And then I listened to that Parliament Funkadelic. Oh man, make my funk the P-funk. I didn't care, that first part didn't matter. The other part, I wants to get funked up. That's what the part that I lived by. Man, I tell you, I no longer listen to the soft stuff. It was like straight to the rock, man. Coming through high school, and then, you know, alcohol opened me up. You know, because from the Mad Dog 2020, we went to the Old English 800 because that was the drink of I want to say acceptance. It was the word on the street that the OE was the drink. You know, so we did some stealing of the Old English 800, and just not standing for something and falling for anything, you know. And then that alcohol opened me up. And into progression, you know, into the marijuana scene. You know, I'm an alcoholic first. And once I put alcohol in me, I become to be a whole lot of other things as a direct result of my alcoholism. There's drugs in my story. But I didn't choose drugs. Drugs chose me. I always chose alcohol. I love the effects of alcohol. I love the effects of alcohol so much that I seeked out every and anything else that would give me that sensation. So if I saw you do something and you told me or I heard that it would make me feel, you know, I was open for it. I began to be a gopher at the end, if you will. I'd go for anything, you know, if it would make me feel like that alcohol did, you know, because I loved alcohol. I loved drinking. A little too much. I loved what alcohol did for me. I didn't like what it did to me, you know. So, you know, coming up around and running and hanging out in the hood, you know, and you know, doing the little, like I said, little fights and wrestling matches and, you know, playing basketball, sandlot basketball, the houses versus the apartments and doing, you know, kid stuff and drinking and all and going through school. School was not no problem for me for whatever reason. Well, of course, I was just at the remedial level. I was just at the general level. I wasn't advanced anything, so it wasn't no problem. Right? Until I got into the 12th grade. Then it became to be one of the first consequences, if you will, that it caused me was that, but you know, as alcoholics, we have this propensity to overcome, right? See, what happened in 12th grade was they had made first and second period first, and then they did homeroom, and then you could get counted for the day. Now, this is all of the scene that I had analyzed and checked out, you know, the alcoholic, you know, you know, just the way I checked the scene, all right? So I got first period, second period in homeroom, and first period was English. And I needed it to graduate. But, you say, but, you know what comes behind, but. In Midlothian Village, there was three laundromats, and in the morning, there was at least somebody in one of them doing something. So my point is that first period cut into my morning drink time. And the school was just right across the street. And I could never get there on time. So basically what happened was the teacher told me, said, there's no need for you to continue to come here for the rest of the year because, you know, you already failed out just on attendance. So the novel idea was, okay, I just quit first period. Now I'm wide open for the morning. And I just graduated in summer school. And that through that alcoholic propensity, I graduated in summer school through the same teacher that failed me in regular school because I sat next to a smart girl that was dating my brother, you know. and so I thought I knew something then, you know. But what I want to go back a little bit about 3 years, you know, because I graduated in 1980. So I want to go back to 77 real briefly to tell you that. That was the night, and I remember very clearly that I crossed that imaginary line. You know, and to go back a little bit further, when I used to go to my grandmama's house in the summertime, I had an uncle who used to come into town from New York, and it was a big deal when he came into town from New York, because my grandmama used to have this big fiesta at her house, and all my other uncles and cousins used to come over to my grandmother's house because my uncle was coming into town, right? And, you know, and this is somewhere around year 75. And it was a big thing, and he was another one of my role models, and excuse me for jumping around a little bit, but he was one of my role models at that particular time, so I always was curious and watched his moves and things, and what I remember distinctively was he drank milk, but he mixed it with something. And I didn't know what it was then, but I remember seeing him laying in the front of my grandmama's front porch. And his own regurgitation it was white, like milk. And as a kid, I drank milk, but he put this other thing in there. So when I got old enough to acquire alcohol, I later found out what he was mixing was scotch and milk. Because I remembered the color of the label, but as a child, I didn't know what it was. But when I got old enough and saw what it was Cutty Sock. And when I got old enough to acquire alcohol, that was the first liquor that I went to. It was Cutty Sock, but it didn't agree with my stomach. Again, excuse me for bouncing around a little bit. I had another uncle who used to come into town, same setup, the big fiestas, cousins and all coming over there. He drank champagne beer with a little dab of grenadine syrup. But when I got old enough again to acquire alcohol in my hood, you don't drink grenadine with grenadine. You don't drink grenadine and Champil. So, you know, I didn't want to be labeled a chump like some of the other guys got labeled as chumps. But what I want to tell you about is in 1977, you know, some 2 years later, when I was hanging out with the guys, you know, we went to this house party. Now, I heard about kegs, but I never saw one, because you got to remember, I was a snatch and grab kind of guy. You know, I was a six-pack of 800 or whatever you could run with, you know, kind of guy. You know, a couple of quarts of Colt 45, you know, whatever you could run with. You can't run with no keg. I had never seen a keg, but I had heard about a keg, and I went to this party, and there was a keg. And that's what they're talking about. So I'm wide open, right? You know? So I had my little cup with everybody else, and they had the squirt, and they was going around squirting, pass the squirt, hit your cup, pass the squirt, hit your cup, and I went, I guess, about three or four rounds, but the squirt took too long to get back to the cup, because I found myself standing there with the empty cup waiting on the squirt. So basically what happened was, after about four or five rounds, I got the squirt, and this time, I'm not letting it go. Phenomenon of craving, right? I'm not letting the squirt go this time. Now, I'm going to squirt you one, and I'm going to squirt you one, but I'm not letting go the squirt, because I got to overcome this craving. You know what I'm saying? So what happened was, you know, I got drunk, basically, and I had to use the restroom. And I don't know whose party this was, because I was just hanging out with the guys. And I had already been invited into other people's houses with laughter and applause. You know, the laughter was called a house party. The applause was because of the reputation that I had with the hard-headed guys that I was running with. But I didn't know whose party this was. But I got drunk and I went to the bathroom and I blacked out. I blacked out. I literally blacked out. When I was able to, they were just banging on the door. Banging, 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 banging. I was able to pull myself together somewhat after sitting back down on the edge of the tub a couple of different times. When I was able to stagger to get the door open, you know, it seemed like there was a thousand people that I had to walk through, you know. And, you know, and I heard someone holler, you know, Mike didn't use the bathroom and he forgot to flush. And that cut me deep, because I was, you know, the great Mike H, you know. And I could sing, and I ran with the guys, and now I'm being ridiculed here, and it cut me deep, you know, because I'm a prideful. And I'm staggering my way down the steps, and I sat down in the living room, you know, and I ate a piece of the birthday cake. And I don't know why I did that, but then this hot flash came over me. So I had to make my way to the front porch, and this was in the wintertime. And I had to take off my shirt, because I was sweating profusely. And then before I know it, the next thing that I remember was that they were picking me up off the front porch in my own regurgitation, just like my uncle. There was a phase of my drinking career where I was a porch drunk. You know, because even after that, I went to a lot of people's houses and got drunk, and they always put me on their porch. So I was a porch drunk for a while. But that particular night, when I was ridiculed about that, and then being driven home with my friends hanging out the edge of the car saying, "Don't throw up in the car," you know, it was like this vigilance came over me. And it was like, I'm never, ever, ever, ever going to let nobody see me get that drunk again. I didn't say I was going to stop, but I ain't going to let nobody else see me get that drunk again. Now, I got close to regurgitations after that through drunkenness, but I never got to the regurgitation point ever again after that. Now, I had a lot of knee-bending, toilet bowl-hugging drunks. I mean, you know, the bed spins, so I get on the floor wobbles. So I get back on the bed wobbles, so I get back on the floor, and the floor spins. So I better crawl to the, and I slept next to the, you know, to the commode, you know. I had a many of those nights, but I wasn't a puker. But that was the night I felt like I crossed the imaginary line, because I took, because my thing was to drink, you know, but you know, not to shrivel or shrink like some of the other guys in the gang used to do. Because if you puke, you was a chump. Now, to get back to where I was at with the high school part, graduating from high school, with all of this vigilance to succeed and overcome and do all of this, you know, suffering from alcoholisms, you know, and I graduated from high school, so then the drive to succeed in life was on. So what? I got to go get a job, you know, because mom told me she didn't want me to go to the army because my brother and sister had already moved on and she didn't want to be at home by herself, so okay, party on. That's what I said, oh, party on. Okay. So I got a job. And the job that I got was it was an alcoholic oasis. It really was. I got a job driving a truck for a wine company. Man, on a daily basis, 250 cases of wine at my disposal. And I disposed of a lot of it. You know, it wasn't even a company truck anymore. It was a weapon. It was it was only by the grace of a higher power that I didn't kill somebody. Because I drove drunk on the regular. I don't know. I don't understand. I just believe that something had to been watching over me. You know. Being a proper member of gangs, I got into cahoots with some of the guys on the job, and I was involved in the theft of somewhere around $188,000 worth of wine being stolen from this company in a 1-year period of time. I had an inside man and so forth, you know. I wasn't the only one stealing it. We was a client, you know, all of us. You know, some of the other guys got caught. So, you know, like the good alcoholic I am, okay, they caught, I'd not run. So I quit. I had a daughter being born right about that time. You know, and I'm stealing from the job that I had. You know, I had a daughter being born that time, and I'm just drinking and doing no, it's all about me and the good time. You know, and I was never able to keep any gainful employment after that, you know. I just went from my hustle, if you will, became to be temp to perms. I go for go to a temp agency, get a job. If I last long enough, you know, if I continue to show up enough or on time enough and become permanent, you know what I'm saying? And then I did get fired, you know. So it was temp to perm to quit or either get fired. But what happened was I got a job, ran about 1986 for another company from temp to permanent and began to drive their trucks. So I checked out the scene, you know, and I got in cahoots and I was involved in somewhere around $265,000 worth of central air conditioning units getting stolen from this company. And there was also a weapons heist that was involved in it too. And one of the three, that was me and two other guys. One of the other guys, he turned state evidence, and then it was the penitentiary for me. You know, I had a couple of little jail stints before that. You know, little 4 days and things like that. You know what I'm saying? And I don't even remember what those charges were because I was always drunk. You know, and they were just misdemeanors, so they pretty much just flew off of the. Police record because it was under the old laws then, but this particular time, you know, it was off to the penitentiary. Now, by then, as a direct result of my alcoholism, I had gravitated to powder cocaine and then smoking crack cocaine. So my progression had really gotten worse. You know, I was, you know, like Bill Wilson said, you know, I was drinking gins with heavy sedatives that quickly landed me on the rocks. So when I was arrested, I really was rescued. Because I was in a really bad state right about that time. Because that crack cocaine came through the neighborhood around about 82. And it was a plague. And I drank with everything that I did. I'm an alcoholic first. And then I'm a whole lot of other things. But off to the penitentiary. Desperate desire to get my life straight. Things have gotten pretty nasty here now because I'm going to the penitentiary. And to tell you, to be rigorously honest with you, I was scared. So I got to get myself together here because I got to survive this penitentiary and then don't go back, you know. Because, you know, I had these illusions of what it was going to be like. And I ain't trying to, you know, be in no cell with Bubba, you know. You know what I mean? But I'm not going to show that, right? So I go into the penitentiary, you know, and I play a little basketball. I'm going to get my life together. I had a second daughter that was born because I went to penitentiary in January 1990, and my daughter was born in January 1990. She was born in March of 1990, so she was born a few months after I was in. So I went in, and I got in with the basketball guys, you know, and got in with the little singing quartet and the desperate desire to get my life straight. And this was in receiver, then they shipped me to a minimum security road camp. And when they sent me to that minimum security road camp, it was a party going on in that place. I'm telling you, they had store-bought liquor in there. They had that homemade mash. They had IV using in there. They had crack smoking in there. I mean, you're talking about the penal system. Gosh, it was just a break. Because once I got to that road camp, and I got right in with the scene. I was drinking and drugging in prison. That's my desire to get my life straight initially. I was a drunk waiting for a drink. And there was no AA there. There was no AA there. I got here when I got here, and it was my time. So I'm not going to say that if it was there, you know, there was just no AA there. I do remember that. But I went on to the penitentiary, came home, got home somewhere around 6:30 that morning, and 2 hours later I had a 40-ounce of Coke 45 in my hand and a 40-pack of cocaine in my hand, 2 hours later, after being gone for 2 years. So I used it in the penitentiary, used as soon as I got out, and I went on a run. It was a vigilance. I had to catch up for what I had felt that I had lost. I came home in 91. And by 93, I had drank and drugged so much of my soul and spirit away, if you will, into such a state of emptiness that I ran to my first treatment facility. You know, because I had lost my relationship with my moms. I had lost my relationship with the kids' mothers and the kids. And I had lost my relationship with myself. You know, with some of the stuff I was doing. I was losing a relationship with water. You know, and things like that. I was losing a relationship with food. You know what I'm saying? I was running with these guys, with guys who was doing the same thing. And I would look at them and I judged them, you know. But the feeling that I had inside, I just couldn't take no more. And I ran into this first treatment facility with the novel idea that if I could just get the drugs out of my life, I could drink responsibly. So I stayed in there 10 and a half months. When I first got there, I checked out the scene, right? They let us go home on Friday, Saturdays, and you got to be back 6 o'clock Sunday. So, novel idea, I'll drink on Friday night. I drink on Saturday nights, but I won't drink nothing on Sunday, so I won't be in the super stupid line with the dirty human because I'm the great Mike H. You know what I'm saying? And I was able to not do drugs while I was in there. You know, because we can, you know. But I did drink all through the treatment facility for 10 and a half months, and then I came out, and 2 weeks later I picked up the drug of my choice, and then I went on a 13-year run that almost killed me. I looked down the barrel of a gun on 3 different occasions. I got beat up twice by the boys in the hood, the little younger boys, because the scene had changed. The younger boys took over the block. I got beat up twice, got hit in the back with a big jack, one of them old car jack hammers, you know, handles. But if I could just get the right job, I would manage well. So I got this job at this one place, and I stayed there for 5 years, and it's the longest even today that I ever stayed on one job, because everybody there was on probation, on parole, pushing drugs or had a charge pending. So they was my kind of people on this 13-year run. But, you know, I was still losing me, you know, because I come from good stock. My mother provided well. And so the things I was doing, they were just against my nature, you know, with the animalistic attitudes and behaviors that I had to take on to survive in the midst of these guys. And so if I just get a better job, I could manage well. Another alcoholic novel idea, right? So I got a better job and made more money, which allowed me to drink more and drug more. But I pointed out that we had a 12-point point system, and I ran my points up to close to 12, so I ran into an IOP to try to save the job. So I went to the IOP. I checked out the scenery. Got detox. Checked out the scenery in IOP. You got to go on Mondays and Thursdays. You got to do 2 sessions for 10 weeks, 20 sessions. Okay, I go on Mondays. I go on Thursdays. I drink a drug on Friday. I drink a drug on Saturdays. I drink them big buckets of water that they tell me to drink, or the, you know, you hear the stuff, the golden seal and the vinegar and all that stuff to clean my system out so they won't catch me. Make a long story short, on the 19th session, I gave a dirty urine and they put me out there, you know, and I couldn't even finish the IOP class, IOP course, and I lost a good job. And not long after that, you know, after my kids, my two kids that I had by the second young lady who had the third kid by then, my third, her second, you know, she wasn't putting up with much more of me after that neither, you know, because I had already started stealing stuff out the house and everything like that, you know what I'm saying? And then basically I found myself sleeping, living in my own broke down car in her backyard because they wouldn't let me in that house no more. I broke it back in there twice to get steal some canned goods because I was just that hungry. But I wouldn't steal from the stores because I didn't want to go back to the penitentiary. And I did break in their house twice and stole some canned goods. But living in the backyard in the car was beneath me. I'm the great Mike Age. Alcoholic thought, right? So I know what I'll do. I'll go live in the abandoned houses, what they call Smitty's or vacants. And I stayed in them for 3 years with the hopes that someone was going to walk through the door every day, one day at a time, that was going to walk through the door and share some of theirs with me. Doing little mediocre jobs, temp to perm thing again. But basically what happened is that it was right about that time that I had my spiritual experience. You know, I did a temp to perm job, and I had rented this room in this 2-bedroom house from this old man that was in his 70s who sold crack and used to do all kind of crazy stuff in the back room with girls. You know, and I had went on this 3-day spree. You know, and one Sunday, that following Sunday morning, after going on that Thursday, Friday, and Saturday spree, that Sunday morning, as I came to on my bed, there was just this feeling of emptiness, this feeling of despair, frustration, bewilderment, and terror. And it was as if my spirit had left the shell of a man that I had became. And it went to the ceiling of the room, and it looked down on the shell of the man. And it was actually an out-of-body experience for me. I was on the outside looking, and I saw that shell of a man, and I glimpsed back to that night before, that Saturday night, and I saw what actually happened to me. I saw what I had, when I had went into this paranoid, schizophrenic, alcohol, cocaine-induced state, and I had locked the windows about 12 or 14 different times, and I locked the doors, and I barricaded myself in that one single room with all of the lights out, with my back pressed against this back, my back pressed against the door, in the dark, with the paranoid schizophrenic state that somebody was in the closet. And it was somebody out the window, and it was somebody out the other window, and there was somebody was coming in from the rest of the house to get me, and all of this was going on at the same time, and I was feeling around on the floor for crack crumbs. All of this at the same time. I saw it clearly. And then I glimpsed back to that present day on that Sunday, and that's when I went to my knees, because I ran out of ideas and conceptions. And it was like I went to my knees, and I said, God, I don't even know what to say to you. And I didn't. My mind drew blank. And without any effort of my own, the only words that came out of my mouth was, God, help me. That old foxhole prayer. But this time it was honest. Because, see, I had used up all of the elaborate prayers every time my butt was on fire before that. And I had ran out of the elaborate prayers. And that's when some things began to happen. Now, I drank twice after that. But I took off and I left. I moved out of the old man's house because I owed him money. You know, so of course, you know, I already had practiced running back in 82 with the wine company, so I was good at that. So I took off, went to stay with my mother. I went to stay with my mother briefly because I couldn't stay there, but I went to stay with my cousin, and I did the Jesus thing, you know, looking for the big bang. You know, they dipped me, they laid hands on me, they threw the oil on me, and I came up wet because I just went and got drunk, you know. I told you I drank twice after that particular spiritual experience. And, but then I found another treatment facility, cause, and this time, you know, it was with the desire to live. because I had had some blood involved in my drinking, you know, from my liver damage, you know, and I really needed somewhere to, I wanted to live and not stop existing. And basically what happened was, I went into this treatment facility, completely surrendered, right? But then after I was there for 30 days, my surrender became partial. You know, I didn't drink and I didn't drug because I had already tried that back in the other treatment facility. So I didn't want to do. I didn't want to hurt no more. I didn't want to hurt no more. It wasn't even about the drinking and the drug. I didn't want to hurt no more because I told you I lived in abandoned buildings and abandoned cars. So I said what they wanted me to say and I did what they wanted me to do. As long as they didn't put me out because I didn't have nowhere else to go, you know what I'm saying? So I was treatment perfect, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, I had this thought, just like I was penitentiary perfect, right? But I had this thought, I want to say and do what y'all want me to do until the day comes when I can do what I want to do. So I'm going to come in here and I ain't going to drink a drug because I want to get to the point where I can do what I want to do. So I stayed in there for 10.5 months and I educated out and I had got a job. And I moved into their transition houses, but I didn't like nothing about nothing because I didn't choose. I took the job because I had to beat their game. I didn't pick my roommate, so I didn't like him. He had ugly feet, you know. I didn't like me because I had no choice in the matter because I didn't choose the apartment that I moved in. I didn't choose who I lived with. I didn't choose. I didn't like me. And the drink started sounding real good, but the abandoned buildings and abandoned cars did not sound very good. So I stood at the turning point. And I was like, man, I don't want to hurt no more. It wasn't even about the drink. But I don't want to hurt no more. But I don't like the way I'm feeling. Now, I had been to 999 meetings through the treatment facility. I heard about sponsorship. I heard about step work. That's when I went back to this higher power that I had had initial contact with and said, look, you got to help me here. And not long after that, 1 or 2 or 3 days later, one of my roommates told me about this meeting that was down the street that was in walking distance, and we had to do meetings with meeting sheets. And I went, that was just part of it. But I went, walked in there to this meeting, and when I walked in this meeting, there was something different about it. There was something genuine. There was something loving about it. The same feeling like I get in here. And I knew it was something different because I didn't experience it in none of the other 999 meetings that I went to. And this gentleman walked up to me and said, hey, my name is Mark. You want to talk? This was after the meeting. He actually took time to talk to me after the meeting. You know, I guess he cut me off before I could get out the door. Told you I was good. I was good at running. He cut me off. And even still, it wasn't over because he began to ask me a series of questions. And, you know, I was still full of it. So I blew some BS at him and he cut right through it. Hey, man, you got a sponsor? I said, yeah, I got a sponsor. You know, when last time you talked to him? Well, I talked to him about 2 weeks ago. What step are you on? You know, I'm right around the 8th step. You know what I'm saying? I just blew some stuff at him, right? Then he looked at me with this look in his eyes. I said, man, what do you want to do about your problem? Do you want help? And I said, man, you on to me. Because I could see it in his eyes. You on to me, man. I said, okay. I allowed him to sponsor me. And this time I went through the steps with him. Now, I went through the steps with the treatment facility because that was the song and dance. But this time I went through the steps with him because I really wanted to live, man. Because I was at a turning point before I met him. And I really wanted to live. So I had broke the ice in the treatment facility. You know, and I had some clarity, you know. And he took me through the steps. And it was an experience that was above level than the experience that I had when I did the step work in the treatment facility. I had experience in the treatment facility, but I only got to the 5th step because, you know, the 5th and the 9th step are where they get you to sign off and then they let you go. So I did the song and dance, but this time, you know, it was just something different because the stage was different. The scene was different. You know, the everything was just different about it. And I got a different result about it. You know? And then I joined the group. And these wasn't the guys in front of the pool or the guys singing on the corner. You know? I joined the group and I just began to just suit up and show up on a normal pattern. And then I began to do what they do and get what they get. See, us group, the whole group began to do a workshop and we all went through it together. It was only 5 of us in the group. You know, and by the end of the workshop, it was only 3 left. But we went through the workshop, the 13-week commitment, where we went through the 12 steps. And that's where the spiritual awakening happened for me, right around the 10th step. It came over me like a great flood. It's like, now I understand. It's not about me. It's about God and others. And when that happened to me, man, it was like, it felt so, it was like, I just, give me more. You know, alcoholic, give me more. And then I began to go with my sponsor to and watch him speak. Then we got a commitment in the treatment facility that I had graduated. And we started going down there on Mondays. And now I'm down there carrying the message with them. I was only getting 5 minutes at the end of the night, but entry level part of it, right? I was all right with that. Just give me 5 minutes, I'll take it. You know, and I throw some, you know. You're going to die if you don't. You know what I'm saying? But after going through the workshop and then doing service and my life just changed. My life just changed. The magic began to happen. I got a new way of life. I began to change the way I look at things, and things changed. The psychic change came about in the awakening. I began to look at things different, and things became different. You know, and the new way of life happened for me through the spiritual experiences through service. You know, the new way of life has been for me that now I get to go to the Richmond City Jail for an hour and come out where I normally would stay. I get to go to Powhatan Prison when I'm in the rotation for an hour and carry the message and come out. Now, I remember going to Powhatan Prison, and there was this little column, this little pole that came out of the ground and had these ropes on it. And I stood there the first night we went back there, to carry the message. I stood next to that thing for 3 minutes. And I reminisce, and I very clearly in my mind, I remember me standing there cutting in with a weed eater. You know what I'm saying? You know, and I just went back there, and I said, man, and now here I'm going in, you know, the closing of the doors didn't bother me too much, the clanging and banging, you know what I'm saying? It's gotten a lot better now. I got so much serenity going in there now. They gotta let me out. No charges pending. You know what I'm saying? No crimes or nothing. You know, and I have a relationship with my higher power today that's none like I've never had before. It's not my grandmother's higher power or my mother's. It's one of my own, you know. And with me and him, it's just you do what's right, right comes to you. And the only thing I know is right is what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, through the steps and through the traditions, you know. I'm just so grateful for this process. You know, I have a relationship with my mother today. You know, who told me, you know, $1,000, I'd be glad when you get out of my house. She tried to get me to move back in when I got sober. No, not that month. No. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me to grow up and become the man that I should, could, and ought to be. You know, I have a relationship with my kids today. You know, I have some joy and peace. I got my own place. First time ever in life. Just got it this year, and I'm 49. First time I got my own name on my lease. You know, I just got a wonderful life. You know, the job that I have today, I was drafted for it. You know, I told you about the job that I lost on the point system, where the gentleman that I work for today, he's the owner of the multi-million-dollar company, and he was the plant manager at the company that I got fired from, that I tried to save through the point systems. You know, there's going to be something that I'm going to remember later on that I wish that I told you, because I got so much good in my life, you know. And for some, it's normal, but for me, I flew to San Antonio, Texas to the World Convention last year, and I'm a guy that used to sleep in a car. I went on a 3-day, 4-night cruise, you know, where they had an AA meeting on it, you know, and I'm the guy that slept in the car, you know. Everything is just so good. I just love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I just love life. And I just want to thank you all for giving me a chance to tell you, you know, what it was like, what happened. And there's a whole lot more good to it. Believe you me, it is, you know. You really want to know what's good, look at your story, you know what I'm saying? Because you know what? I found a piece of that heaven, too. So thanks for allowing me to share.